This is a joint work with my colleague at Temple, Omar Hijab. And I would like to spend a fair amount of my talk motivating this problem, why I started interested in convexity theorem of Chandler-Davis. And the motivating problem comes from the theory of composite materials. This problem has traditionally been studied by calculus of variations techniques, and they've been fairly successful in that respect, but at some point the success stopped, and there were some problems that were still unsolved and that calculus of variations techniques were not able to handle. So pictorially, the relations of my talk with calculus of variations, and this plane is calculus of variations, the talk starts here and goes orthogonally to it in a geometric direction, so there will be very little calculus of variations. It's trying to find alternative approach to solve problems that calculus of variations technique were not able to solve. Unfortunately, I alone could not produce startling results, but I still think that the method has a potential, and just maybe if some more people think about it, and I'll formulate some problems that you can take home and think about them. So maybe some progress can be done in that orthogonal direction. So here's a distillation of a problem coming from the theory of composite materials. We're talking about conductivity, three-dimensional conductivity, and we're talking about polycrystalline composites made with conducting materials. Conductivity is a positive definite symmetric 3x3 matrix, and the space of such objects is called sim plus R3. A subset U is a subset of materials that we built our composites with, and we're trying to find the set of all effective properties of composites that can be obtained by mixing these materials. In practice, we have very little control on how materials are mixed. We can just imagine putting the materials in the grinding machine and then compressing them together, and then there is no way of telling how the little grains are mixed up. So what we want to find, we want to describe the full set of all possible properties that we can create by mixing materials like that. And this is not precisely this. This L of U is actually a set of effective properties of composites that can be made by successive lamination. So we take, say, two of these materials and we laminate them, create a lamellar structure, create a laminate, and then we can use that laminate and create another laminate and so on, and we can make this as many times as we like, up to infinity. And in a lot of cases, the set L of U of all multi-rank laminates, these multi-step laminates, is big enough to cover actually the set of all possible effective properties of composites. However, in general, it's not true. So there is a counterexample by Milton showing that the set L of U can be sometimes strictly smaller than the set of all possible effective properties of composites made with some materials. But here there is this SO3 invariant structure, which physicists denote by saying that we are talking about polycrystals where we do not control orientations of individual grains. Milton's example has to control orientation of individual grains. So it's still not clear whether there is a polycrystalline set U so that L of U is different from the set of all possible effective properties of composites. I'll say. Will be a lot of SO3 invariants here. So mathematically, so SO3, the rotations act on 3x3 matrices in the usual way by conjugation. So that's how the rotations act. And the geometric problem is this. Given a set subset U in sim plus R3, symmetric positive definite 3x3 matrices, we need to find a larger set L of U that is first SO3 invariant and has this very strange property. The W transformation of L of U is convex, where W is this strange-looking function. This function was discovered by Graham Milton, and even though it has two inverses, In fact, it's well-defined and actually real analytic on the space symmetric positive definite matrices. For example, when L is equal to identity, this inverse doesn't exist. But if L converges to identity along in the set where all the inverses exist, you can easily show that W of L will converge to zero. So it's actually a very nice function on a set of symmetric positive definite matrices. So this is this general geometric problem that I would like to draw your attention to. And let me discuss some of my thoughts about this problem. You can take this home and try to think about this one. Here is a little reformulation. So when I was taking a functional analysis course from Peter Lacks, he said, well, if you don't know how to solve a problem, try to solve a simpler problem. Well, if that doesn't work out, try to solve a more general problem. A simpler problem was two-dimensional problem was solved by Milton and Frank Ford. So that did work out, and this is a more general problem. So I'm trying to go up and generalize it to throw away as many details as possible and see if the structure becomes simple enough to say something. So here we have a vector space. In this talk, it doesn't have to be finite dimensional. Only linear structure will be important. We don't care about any topology. C is a convex subset of V. And in this case, the W image of sim plus is that convex subset of V. There will be a group acting nonlinearly on C. In this case, the group is SO3. But again, in this talk, there is no restriction on kinds of group that acts on a set. Just any group would do. In our particular composite materials example, the rotation group acts on 3x3 matrices according to this law. It's actually linear action conjugated by W. So that's why it's nonlinear. And the problem is I'm recycling my notation. Before U was a subset of V, now U is a subset of C. But I hope that's okay. So for a subset U in C, we need to find smallest convex and G invariant subset of C containing U, where G acts nonlinearly on C. So this is this general problem. And we try to eliminate as much structure as we could. In this generality, what kind of question we want to ask? We want to try to tell convexity of a set U by looking at the intersection of U by some plane. So say in this case by diagonal matrices. Can we tell convexity of U by looking at that intersection? And the answer may be if we can solve two difficult problems. Both of them didn't fit on the slide, so here's one, and the next slide will be another. So problem one goes like this. Take any two three-dimensional vectors A and B with positive components. So R3 plus means vectors A and B with positive components. And find the set LAB, the smallest subset containing A and B, such that it is convex and that it is S3 invariant, where S3 is the group of permutations of three elements, but S3 acts nonlinearly here. It's conjugated by this map J that works like this. You just invert first element, and J is inverse of itself, so that's why I didn't put J inverse. So J sigma J, where this action is just ordinary linear action of permutation, just permute the components. Okay, so this is a simple geometric, simply formulated geometric problem that you may try to think about, and I don't know how to solve it. So if you can do this one, then here is another difficult problem where it's actually a conjecture. So this conjecture says that for any pair AB in R3 plus, the set is convex, and the set is obtained this way. So first we construct the set LAB, then we place all the elements in the set AB on the diagonal of a matrix by first inverting the first element, applying the little j, and then placing the triple in the diagonal, and then getting all the linear SO3 orbits of this matrix, and then applying the map W. So the conjecture is that that set should be convex for any pair AB. Right, so what I should say is that here, not only nobody knows how to compute this LAB, even in the case when A is equal to B, and A has first two components identical, so A1, A1, A2, even in that case, I don't know how to compute LAB. So here's where some help should be very helpful. And so here's back to that reformulation slide. So if that conjecture is true, then we can tell convexity of SO3 invariants at U by looking at the intersection of U with the diagonal. So if the intersection is convex, then the set U is also necessarily convex. So that's the theorem. Why it's true will be clear in three slides. Okay, here is another approach. So originally when I started thinking about this problem, the theorem of Chandler-Davis was brought to my attention because it had exactly the same flavor. The theorem said that an SO3 invariant function f of a is convex if and only if its restriction to diagonal matrices is convex. So that's exactly the same flavor that my problem is. The only difference is that the SO3 here acts linearly. So when you have a linear group action, then techniques of Chandler-Davis would apply. Unfortunately, original proof of Chandler-Davis does not work if the group action is nonlinear, and in fact, search of the literature shows that everybody was working with representations or with linear group actions. Nobody was concerned with nonlinear group actions simply because it never came up. So only recently, after thinking about this for a long time, I realized that, in fact, my question concerned sets, and I started thinking about functions. And unfortunately, there is no exact correspondence. If you know, if you have complete information about convex functions on a set C, then you can definitely characterize all the convex sets by just looking at level sets. But looking at level sets does not characterize convex functions. You need to look at the convex sets on C cross R, and then by epigraphs you can get all the information about convex functions. So the two questions, even though they're kind of related, they're different, and the results, therefore, should be expected to be different. And G acts on C cross R by acting on the on C and not acting by R, by acting trivially on R. So let me first formulate the first kind of trivial generalization of Chandler-Davis theorem. And then I'll get to the more interesting one. So here are some definitions that I would ask you to remember, but they're not that crazy that to be impossible to remember. So O of X is the orbit under the nonlinear action of the rotation group of the element X. T is a convex subset of C, and we call this convex subset T a transversal if it intersects every single orbit. And this intersection is called OX sub T, super T, and by definition it's non-empty. A function F is called G invariant, so this is ordinary definition, so easy to remember. Now, there is a little, I was searching for the correct term, but didn't come up with anything better than G invariant. So a subset in T cannot be properly G invariant because T is a transversal, and if you act on an element T by G, it just takes it out of T. But we call it G invariant if when you move by a group and you go back to T, then you should land again in the set U. So GU intersect T is U. So this is so we'll use the word gene variant for subsets of T, understanding it in this way. Now L of U, this usual notation, is the smallest convex gene variant subset of T containing U, where gene variant is understood in that sense. And the script L of U is the smallest convex gene variant subset of C containing U. So this one is usual gene variants. Okay, so here's the first generalization. What it says is that if we look only at the two-point sets and the Chandler-Davis type theorem is true for two-point sets, then it's true for all sets. And the proof is almost obvious. If we take this set of course is G invariant because it's just a union of all the G orbits. In order to prove that it's convex, just take two points in there and bring it, move it by the group action to T, and then here you have your two elements x1 and x2 in T, and by assumption this set is convex. So when you bring it up there, when you bring it back to x1, to your original x1 and x2, you'll see that the line joining x1 and x2 will lie in that set, because by assumption it's convex. But this set is subset of this one, so straight line joining any two points lies in that set. Okay, so that's an almost trivial generalization. And then using that philosophy that if you understand convex sets of C cross R, then you understand convex functions, you get for free this generalization of Chandler-Davis theorem for functions. So if you have this more complicated group action on this new transversal, which is T cross R, and and you have this statement for these two-point sets, that this one is convex, then a gene variant function is convex if and only if its restriction to T is convex. The only problem with this theorem is that it's except in most trivial examples will be very, very hard to compute this set and to tell if it's convex. The proof is almost trivial. Just looking at the epigraph of a function f is the g orbit of an epigraph of its restriction to T. So here's some more definitions to bring us to the interesting generalization of Chandler-Davis theorem. Here T star is any subset of V prime. V prime is a set of all linear functionals in V. There is, as I said, there is no topology on V, so V prime is a set of all linear functionals on V, and T star is an arbitrary subset, and the function f is called PT star regular if it's a supremum of linear functionals with slopes in T star. So in finite dimensional setting, so if V is finite dimensional and T star is a subset of a finite dimensional space, then this set of PT star regular functions is the set of all convex functions whose subgradients lie in T star. And if T star is convex itself, then you can just use gradients where they exist. A convex function has gradients almost everywhere, so if these gradients belong to T star, then this function is going to be T star regular. Now this L of X is this L of a single point X, the smallest G invariant set containing a single point X, and we define this interesting function Cy of X, which is supremum of affine functions over the set L of X. And this C hat Y is the unique G invariant extension of Cy. So this definition shows that Cy of X takes the same values at all points of intersection of the orbit of X with T. So that's why it has a unique G invariant extension. And this one is this unique G invariant extension. Yeah, okay, so L of X is the smallest convex G invariant subset of T containing X. And by G invariant subset of T, we mean that if you take GL and intersect with T, you get back L. So it's it may be quite large set. So for each for even a single point x, it may be a large set. Okay, and here is the interesting generalization. So here is the same setting. So we have an arbitrary group G. It acts on a convex subset C of any vector space. C is convex. T is transversal in that sense that it intersects every orbit. T star is an arbitrary subset of the set of linear functionals on V. C hat Y is the G-invariant extension of Cy, which was defined on the previous slide. And here is the key assumption. We assume that Cy of X is convex on C for each Y and T star. So if this assumption is satisfied, then we conclude that a G-invariant function F that may take values plus infinity is convex on C, even only if its restriction to the transversal is convex and T star regular. So that's the new generalization of the Chandler-Davis theorem. Here's a proof. The proof is very short. So if we denote little f to be restriction of capital F, capital F is G invariant, and little f is its restriction to T, and we assume that a little f of x is convex and T star regular, so it has this representation. Let's define the set F sub x0 to be sublevel set of F of x, and then we observe that since capital F was G invariant, then this set is also a G invariant subset of T in our sense, and it definitely contains x0. Therefore, the smallest such set is a subset of F of x0, and so we have this chain of inequalities. X0 belongs to L of x0, so we have this inequality. L of x0 is a subset of F of x0, it has this inequality. And the last inequality comes from the definition of F of x0, because any value F of x is less or equal than F of x0. So you see that you have equalities everywhere, and in particular, you have this identity. You have this equality, and then we substitute the supremum in here, then we switch the two suprema, and we get this... We get this representation for f of x0, and so we have this representation for f of x. And now, if we use this, our assumption that this function is convex, then suprema of convex functions is convex. So it's a, again, the proof is very simple, so it's a very easy theorem. Okay, so here's a little connection with linear group action. Here, we have another condition so the difficulty, maybe let's go back here. The difficulty is, of course, proving in any particular problem, proving that this function is convex. First, computing this function and proving that it's convex may be two difficult, technically difficult problems. And it's interesting what becomes easy for linear group actions. So here's what. So if we have this extra condition, then life becomes very easy. So this condition says that for any point x and c, the maximum over an orbit of any linear function y of z is achieved at the transversal, where the orbit hits the transversal. Of course, this is true for any y and t star. And for a vast array of problems, this condition holds. So there is lots and lots of... There's been some generalizations of Chandler-Davis theorem in the linear group actions, notably in the context of Lie algebras. And in the context of Lie algebras, this condition holds. And in fact, we in our paper, we prove a little bit more general Lie algebraic theorem that guarantees that this condition is satisfied. So if this condition is satisfied, then this function C hat Y of X has this representation, and this is supremum of linear functions, because now we assume that G acts linearly. And so it's convex, so there is nothing to check. So that's very nice, and the proof here is very simple. This set L of X contains OXT, because it's G invariant. It's convex, therefore it contains convex hull of it, so this inclusion is clear. Now, for this set, O of X, contains X and its gene variant. And for linear group actions, convex hull of a gene variant set is also a gene variant. For nonlinear group actions, that's not true. But for linear group actions, a convex hull of gene variant set is gene variant. So that's a lucky thing. So this intersection is gene variant subset of T, and L of X is convex gene variant subset of T containing X, and L of X is smallest such set, therefore the second inclusion. And so we have, therefore, these inequalities, two inequalities. And then we observe that we are extremizing linear functions, and supremum of linear functions of a convex hull of sets is the same as suprema over sets themselves. You don't need convex hulls when you're extremizing linear functions. But if you remove convex hulls, you get exactly this equality. So this equality shows you that this is true, and so this is true. So here is another remark. In the context of semi-simple groups acting with a coadjoint action on its Lie algebra dual, there is a Costand's convexity theorem that says that an orthogonal projection of an orbit on the transversal is a convex hull of the intersection of the orbit with the transversal. And so this condition yields this. Okay, so here's an application of this new theorem to 2D conductivity. So here, in the 2D conductivity case, the space V is symmetric 2x2 matrices. The set C is a set of symmetric 2x2 matrices with these constraints. It's a convex subset of V. Now, the transversal T has the property that it intersects every single orbit. Therefore, it should intersect fixed points, should contain fixed points. And since T is assumed to be convex, so it should contain convex hull of fixed points. And this set is exactly convex hull of all the fixed points. So this is the smallest transversal. And we were able to compute C hat Y that. Okay, so we were able to compute this function whose convexity we need to study, and took some time to figure out when it's convex, when it's not, and the result is here. This function is convex for precisely these y's, and not convex for y's not in that set. So here, with a little bloodshed, this problem can be analyzed. 3D is a bit scary. So let's see, as I said, the 2D problem was solved by Milton and Frank IV, so let's compare how this theorem compares with Milton and Frank IV. I'd like to emphasize that actually here we're talking about functions, not sets, and so here the results are different than in Milton and Frank IV, because they aimed exactly at sets. So here, if we take two points A and B, this hyperbola is a set of fixed points of the group action. My group action is nonlinear, so the set of fixed points is not a linear subspace. The transversal T is what's above the hyperbola, is this convex hull of fixed points, what's above the hyperbola. This set is a level set of a convex function. This level set is a convex function because let's go back here. The T star is a set of gradients, and the set of normals. So if you take the orthogonal, the orthogonal vectors to y1, y2, you get the normals whose components are both positive or both negative. So components are both positive or both negative. So we can use only lines with slopes whose normals are either all positive or all negative. So here's the set, and that's exactly the G closure of two isotropic conductors A and B. If we take two polycrystals A and B, so they're no longer isotropic, then this is the best we can do. We can join them by a straight line, but then we cannot go like this because the normal has to have non-negative components. So we can go just vertically down and horizontally across. And this is the yellow set is the level set of a convex function that we can prove is convex and G-invariant, and the green set is the true G-closure of two conductors A and B. So we're not able to get this sharp result, but this is a bound. So this is it. Thank you.